goes away.
Okay, well, thank you, Nina, for introducing. So yeah, I've been here for a week or so, and I'll be here for another couple days. So I'd be happy to stop by and see people while I'm still here. So I'm going to be talking about the phenomenology of gravity, which is of course a very large topic in the sense that it is all phenomena associated with gravity and the study of them. But really what I'll be doing is in part making a case for the idea of a distinct role in gravitational physics for people called phenomenologists as opposed to people called theorists and opposed to people who call observers. And in some sense, this is a distinction that people have had in particle physics for a very long time than we have in sort of cosmology and astrophysics. And I guess a way to start would be to do a sort of very brief capsule history of how that came about, of how phenomenology and cosmology has been sort of underappreciated. In the end, though, I'll be making a case for phenomenology, the idea that this is actually something that we should be taking seriously as a separate kind of endeavor. And I'll do that with two examples. An example of how phenomenology as a distinct subject gives you a greater parsimony in your science. And this I'll be talking about work that I've done with Alan Cooney at the University of Arizona and also with Dimitrios Kosoltis. And then I'll also be talking about work that I just started here at Rishadar when I came here. We hung out and talked about some things that seem to that they might benefit really well from a sort of phenomenological approach. So these will be the two examples. And these are the various institutes and institutions that have helped with this research.
What is the last one?
The last one is the Santa Fe Institute. So the first example, and this is the sort of the original title of the talk, is the degrees of freedom in gravity. So let's begin with an older modification to gravity than the ones I'll be discussing. And that's the parameterized post-Newtonian approximation. It was a way of categorizing in some systematic fashion all the different ways that gravity could go wrong, that gravity could differ from general relativity. And so parameterized post-Newtonian, PPN, was pioneered by Clifford Will, who then wrote the book that you probably have on your shelf. It's green. And Nordvet in the 1970s. And it was sort of a general phenomenology of solar system gravity. I think today people think of PPN as a kind of, a sort of open source, interoperable list of things. So, all of the data analysis uses PPN parameters, and then you build your crazy new theory. And instead of having to redo all their analysis, you just simply derive what your PPN parameters would be, what you would measure. And then you can compare them to the results. So I think that's one way that people look at PPN these days. It's just sort of a handy way to look up the constraints that your theory might have without having to do a full analysis. I think that PPN is more than just interoperability. And it's that it's actually contained within it a set of quite deep assertions of physical principles. And what's interesting is the physical principles, or the scientific principles that PPN asserts are rather different from the ones that we do in cosmology these days. So let me just run through very briefly how PPN works so you have an idea. It's a metric theory of gravity. We have a metric that matter calls the geodesics of. So here's just one component of the metric. And in Newtonian gravity, so when you're close to flat space, this is perturbed close to Minkowski. The G0 component of the metric gets modified by something that looks quite a lot like the standard Newtonian potential. This is just the matter density 1 over r. So this is just the 1 over r force, our potential rule for Newtonian gravity. So that's step one. Now, PPN goes to a particular gauge, it picks a particular slicing of the space-time in such a way that the first post-Newtonian correction, the first correction that is of order c to the 4, actually, looks like this. So it's -1 plus 2u, that's the Newtonian part from above, plus 2u squared. So this is the prediction that general relativity makes for systems that are sort of close to Newtonian, but just a little bit relativistic. So this, for example, would describe Wellick's solar system. So they sat down and said, okay, well, this is what GR gives us. We'd like to sort of modify that. We'd like to have a whole category of ways that the actual measure can differ from this. And so, for example, here's what they did. They, for example, put a beta parameter here. So now if beta is equal to unity, you get general relativity. If beta is different from unity, it's something other than general relativity. I'm not quite sure what it is. It's pretty crazy, but there you go. So the idea is, yeah, you have all these parameters like beta and C, I think. And you know, this list goes on and on and on. So you have a big table at the end of it all. And you say, we launched gravity probe B, and here are the lists. And here's an example, of course, of the function that goes along with the parameter. So U at the 5 depth here, and it's quite simple in GR. But then these functions get rather complicated here. So here's another function, which is the phi sub w. And I'm not quite sure. I think these are hereditary nomenclatures. I'm not sure if w means anything profound. One of the fundamental principles of PPA is something I would call matter dictatorship. It's not quite an elimination of additional degrees of freedom, but it's pretty close. So again, let's look at that field that we thought we might add to the metric. And you'll notice that it's composed entirely of quantities associated with the matter distribution. So, and rho prime here is just shorthand for rho of x prime. So this describes the matter distribution. Here's another one that shows up. And again, the coefficient of this one would generically be zero in GR. It's non-zero, you have a non-GR deviation. But all of these fields, all possible modifications are functions of the matter energy distribution and its velocity. So there's also, you can also have internal energies as well. It's not... Yes?
Since that term doesn't show up in GR, then how would you guess that there could be a special term?
Right. So... how would you guess there should be a term that looks like this? Okay, so...
But the second one, the first one, I guess, does show up in GR, doesn't it?
No, I don't think so.
Neither of them show up in
GR. Sorry, I'm missing some. Neither of these show up in GR. So there's a couple constraints that you put on these, right? Okay, so the first constraint, yeah, is matter dictatorship, which to me is the fundamental thing. And that's why I think that has deep physical meaning. The next thing is, because you want to model solar system type things, you like them to disappear faster than 1 over R. So all of these things have to fade away faster than 1 over R. And then pretty much after that, I mean, just kind of nice polynomials, really. I mean, yeah, sure, you could have something that depends on the logarithm of rho. You could make these functions as complicated as you want. It turns out that, you know, Will and these guys basically got sat down and wrote down a couple until they got bored, until they were satisfied their aesthetic needs and stopped. And what's interesting, actually, is that people often complain about when people do that. It's actually worked very well. And the only theory that I know of that should work for PPM, but doesn't just because they miss one of the functions, is one involving Chern-Simons gravity. Now, there are theories that won't fit in PPM, period. For reasons that I'll get into. And so one of the things that is true is, okay, matter dictatorship doesn't quite mean there's no new degrees of freedom, right? So, for example, there are Gram-Zdicky theory. Gram-Zdicky theory is one of the first things that you constrain using PPM. It's basically these additional state forces. And, of course, this does introduce a new degree of freedom, this phi field. But somehow it's the matter that calls the shots, right? So this is matter, right, telling the metric what to do. And maybe Gram-Zdicky is right down here, right, you know, influencing this, right? But for example, there's no spatial dependence to the way the Gram-Zdicky influences it. So there is a sense in which you can get new degrees of freedom, but in general, for example, F of R theories have a great deal of problems fitting in to the PPN formalism. Because generically in a cosmological situation, this additional field, this additional scalar field is now changing. Its expectation value is changing. It has different values at different times, in different places, and on different scales. So that's sort of the philosophy behind PPN. And you'll notice that PPN, in some sense, is not it's not theory biased in a very particular way. It's not, for example, many of the coefficients of these parameters produce crazy theories. Theories that we would have a great deal of trouble writing down, say, a Lagrangian for, right? But PPM, in some sense, by having a couple sort of short requirements, parsimony requirements, got us pretty far in gravitational physics.
I don't understand why Fermat
is
a
scalar
tensor theory.
It's a scalar tensor between Brad's So
it's another Camillion effect.
That
fits with PPM.
Well, so. For example, you look at the debate between Brett Wayne and Mark Kamenkowski on whether or not, good. It's a sort of interesting example, right? Because, yes, FMR generally looks like Grand Stickey. And in fact, it looks so badly like Grand Stickey, it should violate all PPM constraints in the solar system, right? Like, we know the parameter is 1.05 and it's 1/2 in FMR. And so Mark Kamenkowski, a number of people actually pointed this out. But there are mechanisms by which background matter densities can change the position of the FMR field. And something essentially changes mass, basically, right? You know this, right? But because the expectation value of FMR can then can change, right, because of how it's coupled, it no longer is the case that at every point in space, right, the FMR field behaves the same way. So for example, what they did was they put some solar corona in the solar system, and that radically changes the FMR, the mass of that extrascalar field.
I guess I'm saying outside the sun, mm-hmm. That's where you can look at what the new Newtonian potential is in these theories. Mm-hmm. There is a 1/r expansion for you, mm-hmm. 1/r distance, and that will fit in some.
Right, but that would only be true if the expectation of FMR was independent of the background matter density. Right? But the thing is that FMR is the associated scalar field is rolling now. So at different points in time, the FMR has the mass of that scalar field is changing. Right? So in that case, right, the extra degree of freedom now starts becoming relevant in a way that you can't contain within PPM. So
I'm talking about cosmological changes due to a cosmological zeta.
That's one of the reasons FMR can't work. The solar system story is a little bit more subtle. I mean, we can talk. Maybe we should leave that till later. But I mean, yeah, generically, because there's a cosmological evolution to the scalar field hidden in the FMR theory, this PPM does not work in general.
That just sounds like they haven't built in an external time dependence.
You could build in an external time dependence, but then you have gauge issues. You have to worry about how to slice things. And in addition, I mean, you would lose this question of matter dictatorship, the idea that all the entire metric could be defined directly by the operation of the matter fields. Whatever the matter fields were doing defines the metric is no longer true if this phi field is moving max is not simply perturbatively stable. Perturbatively close to a cosmological value. If that cosmological value is moving, if it's having macroscopic changes in the solar curve. It just becomes a new degree of freedom.
If I refer to the system to the metric, so I can also write f of r as a normal gravity plus scalar field, right?
Right, exactly.
So if I refer to that metric. Which would be the Einstein frame, mm-hmm. In that, with respect to that metric, I can do
only if the phi field is not rolling, for example.
It doesn't matter if it's rolling very slowly.
So you're talking about the solar system, right? The reason F of R is ambiguous in the solar system, right? Is a separate question from a much simpler case, which is why it can't work in general in cosmology because the F bar is changing, right?
But isn't it true that this is a nonlinear theory of indensity, basically? The metric is a nonlinear function of density. Isn't it true in F of R?
Yes.
because the density is larger than something. So that, but this FF phi is basically a perturbation in density. So this first term, but these are all the second order terms in density, basically, right? So
it's,
so that's why it wouldn't be sufficient to capture the whole dynamics of it, because that's not linear in density. This is a perturbation in density, right?
These now are, these are not perturbations in density.
But these are all the only second order or first order in density.
So right? this is second order potential.
Yes.
Right.
But also the second order in density, isn't it?
Well, you know, because rho can be as large as you want.
Sure, but we don't have rho cubed anywhere.
No, you don't have rho cubed, although you do have things like this, right, which is somewhat rho cubed.
If rho couldn't be too large, you'd get a black hole.
Sorry?
If rho were too large, you'd start getting black holes.
Right, well, the constraint is that phi has to be small,
yeah.
Not rho. So phi, and of course, you know, phi is easier to make dimensionless, right? So rho, you know, yeah. In the end, it's this combination that has to be small. So.
But suppose, just to clarify the question, suppose all we wanted to do was treat the solar system observations for the last centuries, then would PPM be inadequate for that?
Most FMR theories, yes. I can come up, if, for example, you know, you can come up with pathological cases that are simple to see. If FMR clusters, if you have a scalar wave that passes through the system, this will not work.
Sure.
That's just a simple case.
Well, GR wouldn't work either.
Well, GR, well...
You had a big gravitational wave.
Well, okay, I mean, that's everything, is, you know, how this handles time dependencies, which it doesn't. It doesn't do very well. It doesn't handle time delays. So I mean, we can keep talking about this, right? Okay. So the essence I want to get away, thing I want to get across here is that we have a notion. There's sort of two notions here of degrees of freedom that we have. We have one notion of matter dictatorship, and then one notion of true degrees of freedom. And really, PPN is can only really test one of them. You're frowning stuff.
Yeah. I don't understand the distinction.
Okay, well, we'll get back to it. So PPN as a phenomenological theory for gravity has been very successful. I would say it has parsimony without restriction. Nayef wondered if the functions of the density and velocity that we had were sufficient to cover all the theories we might invent. And to second order, it's been largely true. The only one that I'm aware of, the only failure I'm aware of, is with this Chern Simons theory that I mentioned. So Stefan Alexander has an interesting paper about that. So this has been a very successful phenomenology for things like solar system science. It has some very large downsides. The first thing that it has is that it requires post-Newtonian conditions. So if you're looking to test gravity around a black hole, for example, this is not going to work. It also has a problem that it requires shallow potentials that fade to zero at infinity, right? At some very large distance, you want things to look Minkowski. So it seems hard to get it to work in cosmology. You can actually, and I spent a while working on this, is you can actually adapt the post-Newtonian formalism gauge to cosmology. And so there's this idea that, you know, you're near some perturbation, right? And as you go away, it starts looking Newtonian, but if you get too far away, you start to see the Hubble scale. So you have sort of an intermediate PPM that works reasonably well. You can actually do some kind of post-Newtonian formalism, but there's a problem, which is that, in fact, once you try and do cosmology with PPM, that you see it's actually too broad-minded. So here I said it's nice, it's parsimonious, but without being too restrictive, it actually includes almost every gravitational model we can think of, and a lot we can't. But in some sense, it's actually too broad-minded, because there's only a set of measure zero parameters in the parameter space of PPM that is actually that has features we would consider necessary for cosmology, such as preservation of Bianchi identities. So if you start to modify the parameters, you know, if you're clever enough to adapt the stage of cosmology, now you start to do PPM tests by modifying the parameters, what you find is you have an inconsistent cosmology. So people sort of dig around here. Yes.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
I'm confused. Why would you want to do post-Newtonian cosmology? Cosmology is not Newtonian. It's zeroth order. So what would be the point of...
What's
the meaning of post-Newtonian?
Cosmology is not Newtonian in zeroth order, but perturbations are small. Most gravitational potentials of the perturbations are non-relativistic, right? Galaxy potentials are very small. Galaxies are largely Newtonian creatures. Clusters are as well. So you would seem to think that there is some, you know, you have some galaxy, right? And, you know, within a certain distance, right, say, you know, 50 megaparsecs, right, things look pretty Newtonian plus a little modification. So you maybe want to do some stuff in this range, right? But, of course, once you get to 3,000 megaparsecs, certainly now you're definitely seeing non-Newtonian deviations, right? The potential, quote-unquote, in this gauge is really just the redshift, right? So now suddenly this potential is, you know, is getting very deep. And so the idea is that, yeah, you would want to do your post-Newtonian stuff here and just make sure that you never went too far away, that you never did distances that are too far away. So it's an interesting project, but as I say, I think it's sort of doomed to failure because, you know, you have your space of parameters, you know, beta, and C were the ones I showed you, right? And really, you know, only a couple points on that plot actually correspond to valid models. Models that, for example, can give you a Friedmann equation without major modifications. So you can start and you can go here, but things just get really ugly, basically. So here's matter dictatorship, okay, right? Here's the rebellion against matter dictatorship. And one way to see it is, okay, Mond versus dark matter. So Mond was a very parsimonious theory in a lot of ways, right? It only had one number, the acceleration scale. And that seemed to explain everything you wanted to explain about galactic rotation curves.
I'm saying, what is parsimony?
Oh, parsimony, thriftiness, right? Occam's razor. Not introducing more things than you need to explain the data. Simplicity, sure. But simplicity is tricky, right? The string theory in many ways is considered very simple, but its phenomenology turns out to be very non-parsimonious, right? So parsimony, I mean, I guess I use the term here in some sense to refer to kind of an observational parsimony. What do we have to do? What must we do to satisfy the data? And no more. So Mond was sort of parsimonious in the sense that you only did one thing, you just had one new number, the acceleration scale. Right? Whereas the dark matter people back in the day, they had an infinite number of numbers, right? The dark matter density at every point, right? So in some sense, the Mond people were doing pretty well, but of course it was not a relativistic theory. And so they couldn't make predictions for cosmology. So eventually you come around and, you know, Tevez, right, this relativistic generalization of Mond comes along and a couple other theories that also happen to have Mond-like qualities. Tevez, you know, there's a tensor that's the metric, there's a vector that's new, and there's a scalar that's new. It has what I would call phenomenological parsimony, in the sense that it still has matter dictatorship, but not fundamental parsimony anymore. So you have now a vector field and a scalar field. So here, of course, you know, the end, the bullet cluster, in some sense, I think most people would agree. Right.
It's good that John
Buff. Yeah, I was wondering about that. Right. I was wondering. So I guess is he watching on TV or something?
You might want to answer him just for the record then.
Yes, but his question is.
Well, I mean, I know John Moffat is sometimes here, so I looked at his work and he has a model that's not Tevez, but does Tevez like things. And I mean, look, if you want, right, like. If you know, you see dark matter versus Tevez, who's better, right? You know, I would say, okay, maybe you can make the case that Tevez is really complicated, but at least it's still phenomenologically parsimonious and has matter dictatorship, right? So all you need to know in Tevez is the position of the matter, right? When you know where the matter is, that tells you everything you can know about the theory. Okay, first of all, it turns out that's not true, right? Okay, so it actually doesn't. Right, there's some, for minor reasons, small scale, it has a problem with small scale power, and in fact, the scalar field has to secretly remember some stuff about the matter from a long time ago. So it's not pure matter dictatorship, but in the end, of course, right, this is sort of Independence Day, right, for the matter here, right, this is the bullet cluster, And you can see, right, here is the baryonic matter, the gas, right? And here's where the dark matter is, right? And I think this is pretty clear in the sense of, okay, knowing where the baryons are is insufficient to tell you the metric, right? Because look, these guys have freed themselves, now they're running around, right? So in some sense, okay, Tevez, you know, in as much as it predicts matter dictatorship is wrong, right? In as much as it doesn't have matter dictatorship, right? Okay, it's it's not any more parsimonious than dark matter itself.
Can you repeat for me, what do you mean by matter
dictatorship? Okay, so I know the value of the metric at this point. What do I need to know to explain the value of the metric at that point? If the answer is just the matter,
then that's like Virchow. Are you saying it's Virchow? Does that matter dictatorship?
No, I mean this is like almost an epistemological thing, right? It's like what do I need, right? Okay. What I need to know the metric at this point. If you tell me where all the matter in the universe is, right, I can tell you the metric at this point.
But modulo the right chance.
Hmm?
Modulo gravitational waves?
Well, okay, yes, gravitational waves in some sense, everything you're dealing with here doesn't really release gravitational waves. So that's an excellent point, right? Gravitational waves themselves, you know, violate matter dictatorship. But if you cut out gravitational waves, right? Now here, if I want to know the metric at this point here, knowing where the baryons are is insufficient.
When you say matter, do you just mean baryonic matter?
Well, here we're asking a question, is the, is there sort of baryon dictatorship here, right? And the answer is no, right? Here, I need to know more than just where the baryons are to tell you where.
So what you're saying is that suppose I have an extra scalar field,
mm-hmm.
generically I need to know what the profile of the scalar field is.
You need to know its value at all points in space, right?
And that you would say is not matter dictatorship. So
right.
Whenever there are extra degrees of freedom other than spin 2, and you say that's
well, but then again, because you know certain theories and certain limits look like matter dictatorship, so most Gram-Sticky theories, right? So PPN is a matter dictatorship theory, right? Every component of the metric is built entirely up from the matter. Right, but it can still handle Gram-Sticky, right? So there's a subtle distinction there. I mean, if you want, right, if it helps, just say matter dictatorship means no degrees of freedom. But if you want to get a little deeper, that's not quite true. You can have systems that technically have extra degrees of freedom but don't violate matter dictatorship, such as Tevez, right? And this is why, of course, this thing here disproves Tevez, in my opinion.
So by meta dictatorship, you mean only. Baryonic
matter. In this figure, I think.
In this figure, okay, so this is baryon dictatorship, sorry. But in the end, of course, we all believe in dark matter. I'm just using this example. Okay, dark matter exists, right? So now, you know, now when I'll say matter dictatorship, I mean just dark matter plus baryons. And I would ignore the fact, of course, that they can separate. You know, just pretend, just do a universe without any baryons, which is usually what I said when I eat. Contrast that kind of approach, the approach of PPN, for example, which had a sort of parsimony to it, to what you might say is the age of contestants, right? So in some sense, it's like we had the dark matter, we had a new field that solved so many problems in an excellent way, right? So okay, let's just go all in here, right? So the idea really was, I think, you introduce a scalar field, right? Pick your potential that scalar field is going to roll in, right? Find the equation of motion, and basically just do fundamental physics, right? The idea is we were so close to the ultimate theory of everything, right, that we were almost there. We didn't really have to worry about keeping our theory space large, right? We knew that there was going to be a B of phi, put it in, and then we're done. In some sense, I think cosmologists thought they were doing theoretical physics, right? They would write down a B of phi, that fit the data and had some nice property, like it was a matter of, the tracking potential or something. And then, sort of basically then went to the nearest book on string theory and kind of paged through it until they found that potential. So where are we today with that kind of idea? So this is a paper by Dragan and Hiranya, also Princeton people, showing just, a wide variety of V of phi potentials that are consistent with the current observations, right? So the idea that, somebody would come along and give us a B of phi that was so convincing we could just pack up and go home really hasn't turned out to be the case. And we're really starting now to search parameter space. right? So this is what I call the age of quintessence. There's another way to go if you don't want to add a new scalar field or additional matter fields in the standard way, right? You can take a different tack, right? And you can modify gravity. So these FMR theories, right? And so the idea is we'll leave the matter alone, but somehow we're gonna change the nature of gravity. We're gonna change how gravity gravitates. And so in a sense, one might think, and I think people first looked at this, maybe they thought that maybe this was more like a kind of Mond-like approach, right? You would somehow change, instead of adding new fields that did the things you wanted it to do, you would just modify the nature of gravity. You would have gravity behave differently, right? You would have, instead of being a 1 over r squared force law, it would have a slight repulsive component or something. And the idea was that you could do this in a more general sense than if you simply added lambda. But of course, you all know how this turns out. Having written a theory like this, one can actually transform into what's called the Einstein frame, right? So here, gravity looks sort of non-Einsteinian, but you can transform into the Einstein frame, right? Where gravity looks Einsteinian again, right? It's just R, and now there's this new scalar field that's popped out, right? So you started here, right? You wanted to, but you didn't want to add new fields, you wanted to modify the nature of gravity. So you go to here, you modify the nature of gravity, but that all sort of comes out in the wash, and you get back to a modified theory of matter, just with sort of strange non-minimal couplings in the matter sector. So in some sense, it's harder now to change your mind and say, okay, fine, I don't want to add new fields. I don't want to add dark energy fields. I don't want to modify gravity. It actually turned out to be harder. Right, in some sense, right, okay, B of R is the new, F of R is the new B of R, right? We're sort of doing the same things, right? Now, there are certainly new behaviors that you get with F of R, okay? And they're certainly very interesting behaviors. I would say, for example, you get various clustering scales, right? You get various scales that come in a way they never really came in standard, ordinary kinetic term quintessence. Sort of non-trivial sound speed functions are clustering, right? And so to me, in some sense, right, I mean, I don't mean to be negative about the standard F of R theories. I think they have opened up a large range of phenomenology. But the one thing F of R theories have in common with neophyte theories is they add new degrees of freedom. They add new degrees of freedom to the system. So, for example, matter dictatorship is no longer true.
Mm-hmm. Where does the new degree of freedom show up?
This is fine, right? It's fine here.
Yeah, but in that other language,
in here,
it show up in the equations.
So this actually now becomes gravity. Now becomes a fourth order in derivatives theory.
So you have a higher derivative.
You have higher derivatives. So you need to specify more initial conditions for the gravitational field to know its future evolution. But you can just put those new degrees of freedom into a fine phi dot term instead. Well, because so there's two derivatives of the metric in here, but you can kind of pull them off and put them over here. Whereas if you have R squared, you can no longer start moving things around with boundary terms and getting rid of boundary terms.
Right.
This is really the only one plus negative, which is plus a constant. So that's the standard thing. So yeah, you can just sort of go interchangeably, and there's just a trivial transformation between these.
Probably I should have asked this question earlier, but it's just a lot better than dictatorship. Does that refer basically to only slow-moving matter? I mean, suppose you've got relativistic matter.
Right. So I'm looking, yeah. So this is, most of the stuff we'll be talking about doesn't really handle the question of gravitational waves, for example, nor does it handle the question of photons, relativistic particles. Yeah, I'm looking just, basically, and I think this is where sort of modified gravity phenomenology is these days anyway, is you have all of your dark matter is purely non-relativistic, it's supermassive, right? And also the velocities are sufficiently slow-moving that they don't themselves generate appreciable gravitational waves in the universe. And I suppose, finally, that if there are gravitational waves, they don't couple to the matter. Yeah, so those are all simplifying things that make things a lot easier in this regime. right, it's time for Mars. So we're talking about phenomenology. I think one escape route, if you want to talk about modern quantum gravity, just then forget about it. I don't care anything at all about whatever your theory might be. I just don't care, right? I'm going to go with my telescope. I'm going to measure the equation of state as the standard one, right? I'm going to measure the equation of state as a function of scale factor. And I'm just going to say, oh, you know what? I'll put two parameters in. I'll have a constant and a linear change in A. Right? This is what the dark energy task force is, the standard prescription of a dark energy task force. This is how we should look for dark matter. Right? If you do it this way, if you parameter it as a function of Z, it's easier to get a signal. Right? Some people have reported, there's a report using X-ray clusters. But of course, this is sort of very strangely behaved as Z goes to infinity. So it's not quite clear what that means. So this is, in some sense, a very open-minded way to do the parameterization of the theory. I know how to measure these things. I don't really worry about whether it's possible, if any physical theory can actually produce these. You might say that it's so open-minded, right? It's so open-minded that your brain falls out, right? That you're not really sure what any of this means physically. Right? So for example, say you go out and you measure, right, the WA parameter, the change in the equation state is less than 0.1. So what do you do with that? Is that consistent with structure formation? Well, I don't know. Is it? I guess I'll have to come up with a model that can also do structure formation that just happens to have this property as well, and then I can do it. Right? So there's a sense here in which this way of parameterizing it sort of goes completely the other direction. Whereas V of phi and F of R, in some sense, their theories were sufficiently complicated and sufficiently, defined that they introduce new degrees of freedom. Here, in some sense, they're so ill-defined that one really knows what to do. Everyone really doesn't know what to do when it comes to, for example, combining data sets. So fine, you go measure this in, one survey that has a certain depth, and then you go measure in a different survey with a different depth, or you use a totally different marker like barium oscillations, or you look at the evolution of structure. You really have no way to sort of get independent measurements of these things. So this is sort of one escape route, and I think, for now it's one that works pretty well because the data sets are not yet good enough, right? We really can't measure these parameters at all. Right, very well, yeah. You can measure this, you can measure W0 these days reasonably well, but once we put in a varying equation of state, we're really not constraining it very much, that we're not catching the attention of any theorists anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But one day, right, these things are going to change. And the question is, should we bite the bullet? And I guess by bullet here, I mean, should we take the extra degree of freedom that comes with V of phi or F of R theories as just something we have to have, right? We don't really know, we don't want to do this. We want to have some more theoretical backing, right? We want to make sure we're satisfying more physical principles than these can assure us that we're satisfying, right? But if we want to do that, do we really just have to go to a Lagrangian and build V of phi and F of R theories? Or we can ask, can we do more with less, right? Do the observations actually require new degrees of freedom, right? We can phrase the question that way. Is there a dark energy bullet cluster? No, right? There's no way to really say that there has to be an extra degree of freedom yet. There's no obvious observation that tells us this. And really, we can still ask the question, do we need new degrees of freedom? To explain the observations, yeah.
So you agree if W is the measure to be not minus one, then there are extra degrees of freedom?
No. I believe, for example, if your theory is a classical scalar field theory defined by Lagrangian and W is not equal to -1, then yes, there must be extra degrees of freedom. I believe that.
Yeah, the scalar field itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, because just with with gravity, baryons, dark matter, and the CC, I cannot do W different than -1.
I agree, yeah. Okay. Right, just with the CC, I got the -1, yeah. But right? What if we enlarged our notion of, what if we enlarged our theories to include theories that were not Lagrangian theories? Theories that could not be displayed in a standard Lagrangian, right? So in the same way that PPN includes a whole bunch of theories that aren't Lagrangian theories, right? We don't restrict our PPN parameter space ad hoc, right? We can explore that whole parameter space confident that the guys who built PPN made sure it was consistent at some level. There were no paradoxes, there were no causality bias, there was nothing too crazy about it, but they didn't go so far as to require, for example, that everything be a brand safety theory. Right? And so, of course, you know, finding, you know, I give you a set of PPM parameters, finding the theory that corresponds to that is non-trivial. It may not even exist, right? Especially for these weird ones that, you know, the PPM parameters that talk about internal energy, that talk about the dependence of the metric on internal energy. So, I can talk about something called, well, I don't really have a good name for it, right? Modified gravity simpliciter or something, right? What I'd like to do is I'd like to build a way to modify gravity, right, that retained nice features, such as, you know, general covariance, right? I don't want to have this surprise that the Mond people had, right? The Mond people built their theory without requiring from the start covariance. And so when all the work had gone into it, at the end of the day, they came out with something called Tevez, and I think they were sort of, right? That, like, something that was started out so simple turned into something so complicated when you wanted to make it covariance, right? So I'd like to preserve things like covariance, but I do not want to go all the way and say it must be, for example, expressible as a classical field theory, local classical field theory of exact compression. I would like, in other words, to have some kind of perturbative theory of gravity, a theory of gravity that, if I want to explain dark energy, which is the mostly hinge of this talk, for example, that at large curvatures goes back to ordinary gravity, right? But at low curvature starts to deviate. And I'm going to find a way that allows me to fix those extra degrees of freedom that show up in the standard Lagrangian, that show up in the standard treatment, to fix them in a self-consistent way.
I'm sorry, when you say at low curvature, do you really mean at large distances? I mean, where the solar system is, this room is low curvature.
This room is pretty high curvature compared to the average density of the universe.
Okay. So are you saying?
Like very low curvature, meaning, you know, the average energy density today. Not the average energy density.
Some infrastructure space would not be. Also,
it's very non-perturbative.
Right. So in this room, right, the energy density here is sufficiently high, right, that we would never notice the cosmological costs.
That's right.
Curvature is too high. So I mean in very low curvature regimes, right? Very low curvature regimes.
Oh, I see. You're restricting yourself to a local theory.
Not necessarily.
You said a Lagrangian.
So I should really not have said Lagrangian problems. I should have said all my things are, you know, transforming the ordinary fraction under Lorentz transformation. So I actually am not going to, I'm not going to do the standard treatment of a gravity Lagrangian. I'm going to write something down that looks a bit like a Lagrangian, but assume it's a perturbative approximation, and then in a self-consistent way, fix the extra degrees of freedom that appear, and treat them as if they were fictional.
Also, you're not assuming a Lagrangian, then there's a distinction between low curvature and large distances.
That is true. So in the end, it's really low curvature.
That's really what you mean.
Yeah. As I said, yeah. And in fact, that'll be the control parameter of this perturbative expansion will be expressed in terms of curvature.
If I prejudice that some non-local effects is the crucial thing here. So then that would be something that might show up at large distances, but not necessarily locally at low curvature.
Right. So I'm going to talk a little bit about non-local theories, but actually not non-local theories I think that you might like. Right? These are sort of have sort of vocal non-locality, right? But we can talk about that afterwards. Astronauts have also been discussing this, right? So, okay, can I do this? The answer is yes, right? I can do this in the sense that I may not be able to tell you what the ultimate theory of the universe is, right? But I can do it in such a way that it's self-consistent. right? I don't get any paradoxes associated with it. I have control over the perturbative aspect. I know what my control parameter is. So,
what's the expansion that you wrote?
Here's an example. So this is a little example. I was wondering, people might say, how can extra degrees of freedom be fiction? Right. So here's an example of how you get extra degrees of freedom. Right. I start with a UV non-local theory. Right. So I'm just going to do this, for example. Right. So I start with a UV non-local theory. So one of the terms in the Lagrangian, right? This is the action. One of the terms here, right, is non-local. It depends on a small distance away. Right? So that's UV non-local. Now I'm going to approximate this theory. Right? And the way I'm going to approximate this theory is to do a Taylor series expansion in Q. Right? I'm going to do a Taylor series expansion in Q. So now I'm getting extra derivatives of Q. Right? Now, as Basil pointed out, right, that's what gives you these extra degrees of freedom. Now, when you come to the equations of motion, that guy is going to look like has extra degrees of freedom. Right? If I cut off this expansion, right, I'll have a Q theory that looks like there's all these extra degrees of freedom. But in fact, actually, there aren't. Those are really fictional. So that's one way, for example, that you can write down the Lagrangian. You can write down this here that apparently has extra degrees of freedom, right, but really doesn't. And there's a consistent way to deal with Lagrangian like this if you think something like this is happening. If you think that somehow the full theory has additional constraints that fix those extra degrees, this is a way, right, to handle it in the perturbative case. When you don't have to know. So this will give you an equation of motion, right, if you work it out. Say you just gave me this. You just gave me this perturbative expansion, right? I could get the correct equation of motion for Q to valid in the same region that this perturbative expansion is valid that gives you that back. So that's just an example of how fictional degrees of freedom can arise.
But you're saying the first line doesn't have a certain degree of freedom?
No.
So if there's some non-locality, then one way to think about this is that there. You can write this as some kernel, presumably infinitely number of derivatives, which is why you're the other. But it's not clear that these infinite number of derivatives theories don't have a certain. Perturbatively, maybe, but not perturbatively.
Well, so this is when the action I were talking about is that sometimes you can have non-perturbative degrees of freedom.
Which means that if you were to take that theory, one way to say this is take that theory. If you want to know are there non-perturbative degrees of freedom, take a theory, find a non-trivial solution, remember around this, and my bet is that you'll find extra degrees of freedom.
Wait, sorry, say that again?
So when you say there are non-perturbative degrees of freedom, one way to probe them is to find a non-trivial solution to that theory, perturb the quadratic order on that theory, and you'll find that they're extra poles.
I understand. If you have a theory and you find extra degrees of freedom at the perturbative level, then...
No, around a non-trivial solution.
A non-trivial
around Q equals zero, around Q something.
Well, I mean, Q can have some evolution here, right?
That's what I mean.
Yeah, Q doesn't have to be static.
Exactly.
Right.
That's what I mean.
I mean, philosophically,
I just don't know how to, you can say, I don't know physically how you can say we modify physics without adding new degrees of freedom. I just don't know whether that's
it. It depends what you want to give up. Right, I can modify gravity right now by not introducing new degrees of freedom. I can say, okay, in addition to a 1 over r squared force, there's also a 1 over r to the 4 force.
Yeah, and then we know if you want to do this consistently, something mediates that 1 over r to the 4.
If you, okay, right, so then you bring in new physics. So PPM, for example, PPM just said, I don't care where you get that 1 over 4 r squared force, right? Now you might say, okay, well, actually, I have a larger theory that says, and if you want to get that 1 over r to the 4 force, and you also, you want to do a classical field theory, you want to propagate and do all this stuff, right? I mean, the only thing I can get is you top, fine. If you want to go all the way, if you have a final theory, then do a final theory.
Of course, but I mean, when you,
Yeah. Oh, sorry, no.
No, but I mean, now you're writing a Lagrangian. Of course, if you say, I'm going to write down any force I want or anything I want, then I can.
Right.
But then when you write down a Lagrangian, then you are committing yourself to some story.
Right, so this is an example of how it could go. right? But in the end, I don't have to believe that there is an original Lagrangian, right? I could imagine, but it's so bizarre, right? It's just something I can't conceive of, right? And that's okay. That's not the phenomenalist's job to, you know, conceive of the final theory.
Yes, what's the difference between postulating ad hoc modifications without a fundamental Lagrangian compared to what you were doing on the previous transparency, modifying the equation of state? What have we gained by doing this?
So, for example, we retain a lot of the symmetries of we retain a lot of the symmetries of GR, right? Local Lorentz invariance, it's gauged. You can gauge the Lorentz invariance. So, for example, W bay will never come in another matter of clusters, right? But here, this theory, you know, consistently says, okay, if that's the expansion, this is the cluster you got to go on with it. So you do, I mean, you do get more, right? It's like you get more than W of A, but you don't have to, you know, buy into a, you know, a more fundamental theory. Now, of course, like I said, in the end, right, if you have a final theory, I'll test it, right? No problem. But in the absence of a final theory, one wants to find ways to test it that are not so open your brain falls out, right? So that's essentially the goal here, right? So we can retain a lot of things, but not all of them. And in a sense, right, I mean, I agree, it's very hard to think of a theory that doesn't intersect degrees of freedom, which is why it'd be very exciting if we could show that there were no theories that had extra degrees of freedom. It'd be very exciting if we could show that there was no way to fit the observations, right, with a theory that did not introduce extra degrees of freedom. That's another way to look at it, right? So, you know, today, right, that's chalk, right? Today, there's the theory to be, right? The theory to be is R plus, right? This fits the observation so well, right, that, like, we're really just kind of messing about, right? We're looking for, like, low pressure voltages. And this fits so well. Now, okay, hopefully one day this won't fit so well, right? And people will sit down and write things that look like this, right? Now the question is this required by the data? Do we have to introduce a new field? Or is there some way we can fit the data by not introducing a new degree of freedom?
That's, I guess, that because there are probably heavy fields already present.
Well, there are heavy fields, right? So, okay, so I will get to the sense in which, okay, there may be some areas these are super heavy, and I'll show you how, in fact, those are included in our analysis, right? Because the degrees of freedom are frozen out, they're actually part of our analysis.
So just to clarify Simon's point, this is, for example, what Perturber does when he does this bonds. So there are ghosts in the bonding scenario, basically. But he said that there is a UV complex theory that there is no, that doesn't have ghosts. And if you look at perturbations around that, you ignore these extra degrees of freedom that appear at the perturbative level. So I think that's the same philosophy, that there could be heavy degrees of freedom, but as long as you're below the mass scale of those heavy degrees of freedom,
that's not what you're saying.
Okay.
He's saying, no, I agree with you. Of course, that theory has some cutoff, and there are perhaps naive extra degrees of freedom that eating at that scale, or we're working at much below scale. But he's saying something different. He's saying at the scale lambda, right, which is one we trust, we measured, let's say, some evolution of dark energy. So there's some, we know W is not minus one.
Mm-hmm.
Then from that, as you say, I can infer straight away, I think, that there is an extra degree of freedom.
If
at least I take the bold step of writing down a Lagrangian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. If I cook up some, if I play the game of writing any Friedman equation I want, then I don't know what I mean by degree of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But if I take the step of writing some Lagrangian, then I know there has to be
right.
There is
the extra degree of freedom. I think that's true. If you're gonna describe gravity on large scale by a classical local theory, then yes. Now, some people might ask, well, okay, is there a way to do it without the extra degree of freedom? And the answer is okay, you know, a for sure, yes, it has to be, for example, it can't be a classical field theory. It's gotta be something crazy. It could be, you know, who knows? You would like it, however, to remain consistent in certain ways. You would like it to retain, you know, covariance, right? You would like it to in some sense, right? And once you retain covariance, then you can do all sorts of things. You can do all the perturbation analysis.
Because I think you have personal and interesting point of view about this. So the best from Newtonian gravity to general relativity, would you call it adding new degrees of freedom in your language? Or?
Right. So I guess you're worried about these propagating spin to fields. So.
Oh yeah. Well, I just want to wonder because it's very like.
That, I mean, that's
the
true.
Common view is that whenever you had but if it's not W equals minus one, I have a new degrees of freedom. Like, and whenever I add the objects to a Lagrangian, I make the new degrees of freedom. So this is the common view somehow. So
right. And I am not questioning the theory of how to equation the version of Lagrangian. I really do believe that if this is the final theory, then there will be extra degrees of freedom. Right? I'm just saying, if you want, what is the bare minimum you have to assume? Right? What's the bare minimum you need to do to fit the data that also preserves certain nice properties, right? You don't, for example, I think, right, you know, PPM did allow for crazy fields, right? It allowed for 1/r^4 fields, right? Now, in the end, it turns out that doing that will introduce new degrees of freedom that may, in fact, validate PPM, right? But, you know, for us, so we don't want to do that. We don't want to be as radical as PPM was. And in part, how radical we can be is restricted because we're really a non-perturbative regime here, right? PPM, in some sense, like, one of the reasons it could be so free and easy is because it's perturbatively closed to Minkowski space, or to Newtonian gravity. So, again, if you believe the final theory is Lagrangian theory, and you know that from God, then I have nothing to tell you, right? I can't do anything, because, yeah, I agree with you. There would be extra degrees. So I guess, I mean, there's a formalism associated with doing what I'm telling you to do. Not you. The TV. There's a formalism here, right? Okay, it's been developed, right? You know, we have a feeling it works, right? We sort of know what to do with it. It's all good, okay? I won't really go deep into it. I mean,
so perturbative localization breaks Lorentz invariants. These are theories around how to generate the Lorentz invariant. Their method is what it means. Because they started a theory with infinitely many derivatives,
mm-hmm.
and order by order perturbatively,
mm-hmm.
they just solve
mm-hmm.
an equation of motion.
Mm-hmm.
But the action has two derivatives in time by construction, but crazy stuff in space. I don't want to interrupt you again.
No. That's,
then you are giving up symmetries when you're 30.
My equations of motion that I do, I don't know which paper you're reading, but my equations of motion that I do when, I don't know, formalism is in, mine are covariant. I mean, there is, okay, so Simon did some earlier papers where he was much more interested in quantum mechanics, right? He was interested, okay, and, you know, was not interested in preserving all of the, you know, SF3-1. So a lot of the papers he does do indeed explicitly break that. They have time derivatives, they have space derivatives, but, you know, I am in some sense not really doing the quantum version. And I think all the classical stuff actually retains all the space-time symmetries. So in fact, that actually works out. It's interesting you say that because yeah, it's true. I mean, I skipped over the quantum mechanics stuff, right? When he's trying to quantize these higher derivative systems.
Do you mean covariant or do you mean Lorentz? You seem to use both terms.
Okay, I mean locally Lorentz invariant, and also I've now gauged that, so I get, I have a connection, I have a metric, all those things, right?
Because you can have covariant theories, which are not Lorentz invariant.
Oh, okay, so I guess.
Tethers, for example.
Well, no, but I would describe tethers as a covariant theory, because fundamentally, right?
Yes, it's covariant, but it's not Lorentz.
It spontaneously breaks the Lorentz invariance, yeah. So I would describe Tevez as covariant in the end because, for example, in Tevez I have an action, right? I look at the action. There's no, all of the fields are dynamic, right? There's no preferred, right? That preferred frame is dynamically fixed. So, so there's this case that you seem dissatisfied with.
Yeah, so What I mean by the reps invariance is the reps invariance that we test, you know, that we're competent of,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we have.
Yes.
We have evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense.
Ah, yes.
Just
okay. Sorry. And that's a good distinction. You can say, right, it's whether you can active or passive boost, right? It's whether you boost, you know, whether you go into a frame, you drive your car really fast and do an experiment, or you also make sure to move all of the fields along with you, right? And so one of them is really a theoretical kind of Lorentz invariance, and one of them is more like an observational one. That's true. And so I want to preserve the sort of larger theoretical one that you're right, is not observationally.
So in your definition of Lorentz invariant, anything that you can write, right, so long as you can track all your
use
as a space time scale of all the elements.
Exactly.
So
yes. I'm missing the terminology. So yeah. So for me, yeah, Tevez for me, yeah, because I don't see any indices lying around at the end. Right, I feel like. So if we just look at, for example, the homogeneous case, and we look at the sort of classic, we just take make up a theory, right? We say we have our final theory, we approximate it perturbatively like this, right? We get, for example, for the homogeneous evolution of the universe, this is the new Friedman equation. It produces, you can see, if you're, if you've done cosmology for a little bit, right, you can see clearly this is going to do some kind of acceleration, right? As the matter density drops and drops and drops, this term here becomes larger and larger.
So the first theory is not meant to use a freedom, right?
This one?
No.
It's a bar theory, so.
It's a function of, how do you write a function of?
So.
Expand, right?
Does this theory, right, does this theory necessarily have extra degrees of freedom? That's up in the air. It may or may not, right? I can treat this theory, right, as if there are these additional terms secretly in here, right, that will constrain the extra degrees. In the same way, right, I can have a ghost here, right?
Yeah, but then you cannot trust that theory at the scale, on scales that are order new.
Right, and I cannot trust this theory. I cannot trust this theory on scales of order r close to 4. Right.
You can only trust it for r.
For r much larger than 4. Or v squared. Sorry.
No, your degree of freedom will be there at scales r larger than 4. If you write it as a scalar tensor theory, the scalar. Has
right. If you write it as a Lagrangian theory, then I agree with you. There are extra degrees of freedom. But this, in some sense, don't think of this as an action for this. Don't think of this as the standard thing, how to get the equation of motion from this in the standard fashion, right? Because there are things here, hidden in here, that will constrain the extra degrees of freedom, right? We don't know what they are, right? But the thing is that if you stay perturbatively close to Einsteinian gravity, right? If you stay perturbatively close, I can tell you how that fixing will happen. Without knowing the final theory. And yet this is unfamiliar stuff, right? This should not be familiar. This is not like effective field theory, massive degrees of freedom representation. It's not what I'm saying. It's not what I'm saying. This is new, right? You haven't seen this before, really. Unless you've got this stuff before.
But this is, what have we not seen before? It's the dots.
It's the dots! It's the dots. Yeah, sorry.
Are you certain that there's going to be a way to do this, or can you prove that these extra degrees of freedom to appear manifest when you write it this way can be somehow tied away? Because it seems like it's sort of like you add a degree of freedom to a constraint in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore you don't have a new degree of freedom. Is that more or less true?
Pretty much, yeah. And the thing is that whatever that constraint is, in the perturbative, you stay perturbatively close, all those constraints look the same. Whatever the theory is, in the end, all those constraints will look the same. That's the point. You don't have to know the full constraint of the theory to do this. You don't have to know the final theory.
But
What I'm not understanding, what is that arrow? That arrow is just the usual derivation of the equations of motion.
No, no.
That's what we have to understand.
That's why you have a friend.
Yeah, what, how did you get, how did you get from that to the ground that's not really on the ground?
Oh, how did I do this?
Yeah, how did you get to this?
So, I mean, it's reasonably simple, right? You build the equation of motion, right? But the higher order terms you fix to be perturbably close to the lower order terms. So it's actually, in the end, like heuristically, how you do it is pretty easy.
So you derive the equation of motion in the usual way, but you
derive the equation of motion in the usual way.
You limit the class of solutions to those which are perturbative to the...
Yeah, exactly, yes.
To the pure Einstein theory.
Yeah.
So you know that you know this work of modified source?
NIH tells me, right, this is something that I'm ready.
What they do is a bit simpler than what you have, so... Instead of starting from this action, they just say, let's start from Einstein gravity, plus they add some Lagrange multiplier in coupled to the trace of the stress tensor. Mm-hmm. And then when you solve the Lagrange multiplier, they claim they can get any function of rho on the
right
hand side.
Right, so there is, right, so there, like, one of the things I'm restricting here, right, is in some sense I'm modifying only the gravity sector. Yeah. Yeah, this came out when I was looking at, I think, Niyayashi's Piscatone stuff, or not that his gravity negative stuff, a similar kind of thing. And so that's true, it's a class of theories that are not covered by this. Right, this is your only modifying the gravity center. So, yeah. So, right, yeah, I mean, is the magic in the dots? No, the magic is not on the screen, right?
This is what many people do, and I think some of you have seen this. I mean, like Weinberg does this to do inflation, but not as an IR, not as a UV expansion, but as an IR expansion. And also, I think for the bonds, Bert does that. And again, I think.
I mean, this is. I think it's very different because things don't. This is not valid at low. This is not like low energy.
But
stuff.
You assume that this the second term must be small, so your thing breaks down if the second term becomes large, right?
Right, so one of the questions is what's the control parameter here, right? And the control parameter actually is contained up here in this expansion. So, right, you can get large acceleration, not large, sorry, you can get the acceleration we see today, right, without breaking the perturbative consistency of the theory, right? You can get what seems to be a non-perturbative result, but that's simply because these things are not gauge independent. In the end, right, it's actually reference to R. This is the relevant question here, not H versus mu.
Can I just understand the domain of application of this? So if we're just starting to see acceleration, then it's okay. But if we got to the stage in which the acceleration dominated, then we wouldn't be able to use
Yes.
Kind of analysis.
No, yeah, precisely, right? We would need, so this is in the end, if you just relate your observable quantity, right? So this is the acceleration parameter. So when Q goes to 1, right, this breaks down, right? If we're very close to, if we get too close to the Sitter space, no, this doesn't work, right? So another way to put it is if we saw we were very close to the Sitter space, right? Then we would know we need extra degrees of freedom. Unless, of course, there's always the out, right? The out is always problem-muscle constant works, right? So if it's not a problem-muscle constant and you see you're close to the Sitter space, then you need extra degrees of freedom.
Well, when you say extra degrees of freedom, that bias is, that's a biased way of saying it, perhaps. You just mean new physics, a different kind of physics. It might be some new degrees of freedom, it might be some non-local physics.
That is true. I think that is true. So, okay, in the alternate universe where I'm giving this talk and Q is 0.9, okay, then, or, 0.99, then, yeah, actually, not quite sure what I would say. Turns out, I don't have to worry about it. But
There's some vague, maybe it's more than vague analogy with sort of the Dirac equation for the electron, Lorentz Dirac.
Yep.
Is that the same sort of philosophy that you're trying to build in here?
Yeah, that's another case in which you can use these,
Sort of von der Lipschitz version of the equation. What you're trying to write down.
That's another situation in which you can use the same technique to get the correct answer. So it's a bit old school, right? Like I never went through that in macrodynamics, but yeah, that's one of the ways you can do that case. So again, there you don't really know what the you've got yourself into trouble with the classical theory. You want to get out.
So you married that action, r plus 1 over r, let's say. Suppose you did that.
Yep.
Okay, and then you solve the equation of the motion perturbatively around the solution, which is...
around the GR solution.
Around the GR solution. So have you done that exercise in the scalar tensor language? Because you could do that, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is, right, this is like the first step of our theory that ever was done.
Sure.
Right? And we get very different behavior because these guys have to choose the initial conditions for their phi field.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And even if they do, it turns out to be unstable, right? Their phi field is unstable. They don't get proper matter and radiation transitions. The whole bunch of everything goes wrong, right? That extra degree of freedom,
yes.
If you treat it in the exact case, if you say my final theory is F of R, it doesn't work. So again,
in the same approximation that you're working in, namely that phi field is doing something here in your combined phi freedom, although a small correction, it's presumably responsible.
Although a small correction is right, so I mean
that is the mutant of our world. You say it's a small correction.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Right.
The constant of that must be phi. No?
Right. So I mean they can of course continue. You know, because they have the exact, they can go all the way.
Sure.
Right. So at some, they can go past, and we can go past. They also have instabilities, right, in the theory as well. But of course, we can just pretend somehow that those instabilities don't arise. In which case, yeah, we do agree at that level.
Okay.
So.
Can I just?
Yes.
Just for my understanding.
Yes, yes.
To unpack the red arrow a little bit more.
Sorry, yes.
Not the doubt.
Yeah, so this is, yeah. The cartoon. This is cartoon.
So you get the equations of motion from that. They're fourth order equations of motion.
Mm-hmm.
But when you see the higher derivative,
I can break wrong.
You solve them as if the higher terms weren't there somehow.
Right.
And you plug in for them what you would get from the second order.
And then that modifies exactly.
And that modifies
precisely. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's very simple. Right. It's very simple. So in some sense, right, like there have been 100 F of R papers, right, we're about to I'm about to show you all of the F of R's in this fashion. Right. So, right. Control for error, right? Interesting, right? You can still, this is not, we're not non-perturbative, we can still do this, right? So that's, I'm very fascinated by the every trial that I discovered.
You
agree
that, sorry, this is what I don't understand, sorry, but you are using an extra degree of freedom to make that correction, right? And but you say, oh, but it's a small correction, but still you are using the extra degree of freedom. So now you're saying, oh, but there's not really a degree of freedom.
In this case.
It's all in the extra dot that I'm not showing you.
Yeah.
But if that's the case, then it means that in order to be able to describe that correction accurately, I must know these extra dots.
No.
You're telling me the extra degree of freedom is not there.
No,
there's something else that's killing it at the
right.
The
so this, I mean, this is exactly it. Now,
yeah.
Not perturbative, that's true.
Okay,
right.
So then I cannot trust your correction.
You can trust them in the perturbative regime.
No, you cannot, because if you're telling me that degree of freedom is being killed by some terms in the dots,
mm-hmm.
then I cannot trust the correction that you're telling me due to this guy, because there's
all
something
of
that
the,
order, which is, you know,
all the ways to do that constraint,
right.
They all come down to the same thing in the perturbative case. As long as you don't secretly put a new degree of freedom in, right? Okay. But you have to constrain the whole thing, right? But all those constraints amount to the same thing in the perturbative regime.
So here's an example. When a charged particle accelerates its radius, and radiation energy is proportional to acceleration squared. So that's a higher order theory. But you can treat it perturbatively, and there is no extra degree of freedom. And there are that are radiated, but of course you don't care about them, and they're only eventually perturbatively. So that's not a sick theory. And you only need to know that first order term. That's enough to
exactly that gets you the right answer.
Right.
You don't have to know the higher theory. If you just know right exactly, that's a good way to put it. Right. It's a good example. If you know if you know the higher derivative theory, right, that gives you the acceleration, that gives you the radiation, right. But you don't know what the fundamental theory is, and all you do is say the fundamental theory constrains it to be second order, there's no extra degrees of freedom, then you get the right answer. Now, in all possible mathematical worlds, I'm not sure if it's been proven with the little box in the QED. Okay? It would be interesting if you can come up with a counterexample. Right?
Of course, an example of this is any effective field theory I write down. There will be high order corrections due to some new physics at some high scale.
New degrees of freedom.
I don't need to know them.
You excite the new degrees of freedom now. That's great. So that's the one
not
thing.
Not necessarily. I can say, you know, whatever is out there, I don't know, but mm-hmm. much lower scales. This is my effective field theory, and I know what are the like degrees of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
The difference that I think is confusing me now is that here you're doing the opposite right here.
This is not effective field theory. It's true. Yeah, it's true. So when you
you cannot invoke decoupling to say that these degrees of freedom.
That's true. I never have invoked decoupling.
Yeah,
so this is the thing. I guess this is the thing that always I think when I test people up on this when we talk about it, right? This is not effective field theory, right? This is not what you know, right? This is very different, and it's not particularly close to effective field theory, right? It's a whole new way. It's a whole new thing. It's been in literature for a long time, right? And it's just not really used that much. I think because all of those kinds of theories generally, this is the Lagrangian error, right? We write up Lagrangian all the time, so we never really need to do this, right? This never comes in. If you see a degree of freedom and it's, you know, it looks light, then it is light, right? That's always going to be true in the Lagrangian case. But we're trying, I'm not claiming to be a theorist, right? I'm not claiming to know the Lagrangian, I'm just claiming to ask, like, is that necessary? That's why I call it phenomenology. So, I mean, that's the thing. This is it's new, right? It's not going to get you. It's not going to help you train you, right?
Is this like a new postulation? You're saying so before the problem was that we thought we're going to get a new degree, and now you're saying maybe we are not, but we don't know either way.
Right. So we would like to know if you require a new degree of freedom, right? If you require a new degree of freedom in gravity, right? Is it required by the observation? That's a question you can ask. Now, again, right, if you say, I know my theories, I know my gravity explanation is going to be classical Lagrangian local, right, then you also know a priori there's no extra degree of freedom, so you don't even have to look up, you don't have to look in your telescope. But, you know, science, right, you want to ask that question. This is a systematic way to ask that question.
You didn't have to write the Lagrangian experiment. You could have just written down the equations of motion first. And apply the same.
That is true.
Identify with
the
pure GR term.
That is true. That's another way to look at it. Yeah, I could have modified it. So then, of course, because then you start now blowing up again, right? You can modify the equation of motion anyway. So that's sort of consider again PPN, right? PPN has some basic assumptions, and it also puts some restrictions on the nature of those fields, those potentials if you go in, right? So we would like to have some systematic way of doing that. That's true. I mean, in some sense, yes, right? The space of theories is uncountably infinite, right? So I'm going to, I'll show you sort of how that goes through here, right?
It's already uncountably infinite because you have a free parameter.
Right, so this is like the square, see, all right, okay, I'm done. Okay, so I shrunk. now it's mildly constrained in my thing. So, like, one thing that's nice is you can do these pretty quickly, right? You can explore the parameter space pretty quickly, right? So we just quickly looked at, for example, say the perturbative expansion of your fundamental magical theory looked like this, right? It's some function of R and some function of the Gauss-Bonnet. Just pick two nice scalars. If there's no cosmological constant here, there's no cosmological constant in here, it's ruled out. There are no, right, so this is like a result here, right, in the sense that there are no theories, right, there are no theories without extra degrees of freedom that look like this, that fit the data, right? So then, okay, and it's just, for any, so okay, the caveat, right, it's a polynomial in these things, right? So, that's just with that homogeneous expansion alone, right?
Isn't that automatically produces W less than minus 2?
Yeah. Effective W. And again, it's not, you can have W can be anything you want, in some sense.
That means the measure of W, the supernova.
Right, yeah.
W.
Yeah, so exactly, this is ruled out, right? This is ruled, this value W is already ruled out by W not plus supernova. So all those theories are out. Boom. All right. Okay.
What sets omega lambda?
It's this mu to the fourth term, right? That's the guy who sets omega lambda. But in the end, right, it's just a W is wrong. W doesn't work. So you can get the correct omega lambda. You do need the supernova to do this. So homogeneous expansion, you just killed a bunch, right? It took 10 minutes. You might now sort of expand, right, and start doing all this chaos you can think of, right? So again, it's sort of this, sort of naive covariance, right? You just want to make sure all of your indices are gone, right? So you can quickly do all of these, right? And we're just sort of looking at these here. But what's nice is because, right, of the covariant rate specifying, right, we can also get, right, I showed you the Friedmann equation, you can also get the structure formation as well. One gives you the other, or rather, something else gives you both, right? So you can very quickly cover a large space here. Now, in some sense, of course, you can start adding derivatives to the R's, right? You can start adding derivatives here. Things start to get complicated, right? And at some point in time, you may have to say, okay, as with PPN, right, I'm going to restrict the nature of those modification fields, right? I'm not going to be able, for example, to have a potential that's composed of a logarithm. Just because there's no way to write, there's just too many functions. I guess, here's just another case, right? These things start dropping out pretty quickly. So in fact, many of these functions, even the homogeneous case are very hard to fit, right? And the lesson you're taking from this, right, is that in fact we're very rapidly exploring, right, all the possible ways to modify gravity that don't introduce a new degree of freedom.
But they're all local, at least in the real sense, in the underlying sense of the word.
Right. So this is one of the questions. I'll give you a touch of this. This is an important part that remains to be done, right? It's okay, fine, right? I have this way of quickly going through various non-local, various modifications that have no extra degrees of freedom and consistency. I got to go out now and find some theories that look that way, that find some exact theories just to see. For example, right? Yeah, maybe in fact, like some really nice, interesting, exact theories, right, don't look like polynomial functions, right? It's something you gotta check. I mean, this just seems reasonable because who knows what else to do. Now you have to go out and find some exact theories, right, and just see what they look like when you approximate them, right? When you approximate them in this way. And so, that's one of the reasons, one of the things Niyaj and I talked about, right, is, there is, Niyaj has this Kuskutin field. There's also the gravitational ethers. And we've sort of been going back and forth about whether or not, for example, Niyaj's work has an extra degree of freedom or not, right? So Niyaj, and I have been debating, for example, whether the Kuskutin has no perturbative degrees of freedom, non-perturbative. I mean, these are open questions, right? So one of the things we have to do is if someone's actually got a final theory with no modifications, with no extra degrees of freedom of gravity, then we need to look at it. Because we want to look and see how that actually translates into our sort of general PPN-esque language, right? In the same way, when, Will and these guys invented PPN, right, they had a bunch of parameters, and the question was, what do those parameters correspond to? Do they actually correspond to any nice theories that are lying around anywhere? And the answer is yes, they did, in fact. They guessed some good functions, and they just guessed simple ones, and it actually covered a very large space. And it covered the right space. It didn't go off into some, it didn't cover some separate neurons. So I I have a whole other section, but I won't do that. So I probably specify stuff here, but thank you very much for your attention.
You already have lots of questions, but any remaining ones?
Yeah.
I don't understand why we aren't already far from the perturbative machine. Omega lambda is around 2/3 or something like that.
Right, so this is a good question, and I'm one of the things is that a lot of the things that you might spread Q and H, right, these are gauge-dependent parameters. And so they don't necessarily translate directly into actual, you know, whether the fundamental physics is, you know, you're in the correct degree of fundamental physics. So, for example, you could take Minkowski space, right, and just do a Milner universe on Minkowski space. Now you have a huge H. Right, so it's the gauge there that's tricky, and we think that the control parameter is indeed composed out of R, and in fact, if you look at that, if you make that control parameter, in fact, today we are still close enough that we are in the perturbative regime. So I'll be here until Thursday. So please email me or come back out because I'm on the fourth floor by the beach. So thank you very much.
Or in the library, most of the time.
Well, no, now that I finished this talk, right, I'll be out.
No more questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.